Crave, episode 68, take 3.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and welcome to Crave, episode 68, in case you're counting. This is the podcast dedicated to music, movies, theatre, in fact, anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
Now, this week, let's face it, the word legend does get thrown around an awful lot when we're talking about musical artists. But in the last couple of days, Simon and I, we've been to a concert from a man who, I think it's fair to say, does qualify for that label. That would be Bob Dylan.
It would be. Also, another big star, not in the same stratosphere as Bob, at least not in my book, but still hugely popular. Steve's been to see a Katy Perry concert.
Yeah, not quite in the same stratospheric level, but, you know, worth talking about.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. Now, still with music, definitely not a legend yet, but, you know, it's time. We've been listening to a sneak preview of the new album by Passenger. It's called Runaway.
It is. Now, to the movies, one which has been causing quite a stir, certainly amongst the media, who are claiming that the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians breaks new ground. Well, Steve and I will compare notes on that.
Yeah, not quite so sure about new ground, certainly. But anyway, another one that, definitely not breaking new ground, or indeed new water, but also Strong Asian Connection and a Kiwi one. In fact, a personal one, let's see if we can go there. The Meg, with about as big a shark as you could really hope to see, but is big always better?
I would suggest no. We'll get on to that.
Diminishing fishy returns?
I knew you were going to get your bite into that comment, Steve.
Ouch.
Now, as we said in the intro, we are up for sampling popular culture in all its forms. And so with that in mind, I've been reading the first graphic novel ever to be nominated for the prestigious Man Booker Prize. It's called Sabrina. We'll get to that a little later.
Now, we have teed that one up in previous weeks, but yeah, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay.
But in the meantime, yes, let's see what we've got to say about Bob. So he's odd, isn't he, to be honest? I mean, you've used words like mysterious and aloof, and I'm going flat out odd. He's he's a musician who's won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's often rated as one of the most influential artists, and I think that's beyond doubt. Whether you like him or not, you can't deny his omnipresence through the decades. He's certainly he's been a presence in modern popular music since the 60s, and he's just performed in Auckland and in Christchurch. Now, Simon, you and I were at the Spark Arena show in Christchurch on Sunday night.
Auckland, actually.
I'm sorry, did I say Christchurch? I did, didn't I?
Yes, I know you're a jet setter, but no, we were in Auckland.
We were indeed. We were both in Auckland, and so was Bob.
Yes, that's right.
Now, this was your second time at a Bob Dylan concert, I believe.
Yeah.
It was
yes.
my first.
Yes, and I suspect, in fact, I know, that's going to make a bit of a difference to how much we appreciated this show. Because, let me say right off the bat, Steve, when I saw him the first time, which is not that many years ago, a few years ago, I think on his previous tour, he did a show at the Civic Theatre in Auckland, I actually left being rather disappointed. I didn't really get my head around it. This time, I knew what to expect, and I enjoyed it a lot more. But for you, as your first concert, what did you make of it?
Well, I think I used the word odd earlier, and I'm going with that. I'm not sure we can even really call it a concert in a conventional sense. I felt like we were being granted an audience with someone who knew how important he is.
Okay.
Well, I mean, think about it. You know, he comes out on stage to very little fanfare. The audience, the band come out one by one and start picking out a rhythm. He wanders out, sits himself behind a piano, and starts playing. I think it's fair to say that most of the audience, yourself included, who were familiar with his work, didn't even know what song he was playing.
Yes. Well, I think that is yes. And the first time I saw a show, I found that incredibly frustrating because I wanted to know what the song was. And often it wasn't until he started singing some words that the penny dropped and I realized what the song was, because he has this reputation, and he does it. He completely rearranges many of his songs, and the instrumentation is so, not the instrumentation, even the melody sounds so different. You really you just wouldn't know. I mean, you really wouldn't. And this concert, Steve, there were many songs which were, you know, standard, solid, well-known Dylan singles like Tangled Up in Blue and Simple Twist of Fate, It Ain't Me, Babe, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, Ballad of a Thin Man, Desolation Row, you know, big, big Dylan songs. And you'd have been struggling to have picked them if you were just relying on hearing the music alone. And that's what he does. He reinvents his music, and he's still doing it at the age of 77, even to the point of rewriting lyrics, which I found really interesting.
Which ends up meaning that they're not the same songs anymore. So you show up to a concert not having any idea what you're going to get.
No, I think that's probably fair. And the question is that a bad thing?
And I can't decide. I'm really, really torn on this one. I don't know. I mean, I'm not as familiar with the songs as you are, so I'm not missing out on not on the experience. I'm not going with the experience of not getting to hear the song I wanted to hear. So yeah, so he would play a song that features some, not even all, but some of the lyrics of, let's say, Tangled Up in Blue.
Yes,
but you can't. He can't meaningfully be said to have played Tangled Up in Blue.
No, I know. No, well. A version of it, yeah. I think, you know, here's the thing that crossed my mind when I was listening to the show, Steve. I remember last year seeing Cat Stevens at the Spark Arena.
Right, yes.
A guy of sort of the same vintage, a little bit younger, but who did some really lovely, beautiful, heartwarming songs, nicely written, wonderful melodies that stay in your mind. And I found that even though he had a newish band, and he tried to give it a bit of a fresh twist, effectively you recognized all the songs.
Yeah.
And that became a richly, deeply emotional experience for me. And I found I had tears in my eyes for many of the songs because I just thought, oh my gosh, there it is. That's the one I know and love.
Yes.
But Mr. Dylan is not like that.
No.
He goes to your head as much to your heart, maybe more to your head than your heart. And he still, that's the territory in which he is operating. And I guess he's... you know, he's kept that aura of mystery, hasn't he? He's giving you fresh. It's almost like you're quite right. It's like a fresh concert, new material.
Yes.
He's demanding your attention. He's not saying just sit back and relax and hear the old tunes. No. You've got to sit up and take notice if you want to get the best out of this.
And you're certainly not going to sing along.
Well, no, you're not. You're not. You really aren't. And no one did. Not at all.
No, songs that I knew, like Blowing in the Wind, were unrecognizable.
Yeah, they were. They were.
Now, one thing we have to talk about also that we've not even mentioned yet is that voice.
Okay, yeah. So I can hear something in your voice. What do you make of?
He's always been a bit singular, hasn't he, to be fair? He's been a bit distinctive. There's always been the slightly nasal whine. You know, how many roads must a man walk? I mean, he's almost sounding like Liam Gallagher for a second there. I can't do him justice. But there's always been that sort of nasally whiny quality to his voice.
Yes, that's true.
But now, with age, it's now dropped a couple of octaves and into the gravel.
Yes, it has.
And now he's a whiny voice. And I couldn't get on board with it. And at one point you turned to me and said, well, he's changing all the lyrics. And I was thinking, how can you even tell?
Well, okay, I have an advantage over you in this area just because I've actually come to Dylan quite late in my life, Steve. I mean, I was aware of his big songs as a youngster, but never really bought an album. And I've actually only started really listening to full albums of his in the last 10 years of my life. And the ones I've listened to have been the later ones.
Right, okay.
So there's Modern Times, which won a lot of Grammy Awards about 7 or 8 years ago. Maybe it's more than that now. Together Through Life, Modern Times. And in these later albums, he has that gravelly voice.
Right.
He's had it for a little while. And so I've got attuned to it, and I'm not saying I picked out every lyric. I think the sound mix wasn't perhaps quite as good as it could have been.
No, he was a touch low, night. Wasn't he?
Yeah, but I got quite a lot of the lyrics, not all of them. But yeah, I knew that was what I was going to be getting. That sort of higher pitched nasally quality that you rightly say he used to have has faded away somewhat and been replaced by this lower gravelly sort of sound. So
I wrote in my notebook Leonard Cohen on Ambien.
Oh, well, yeah, okay, all right. What did you think of the band? Because that was another thing we sort of swapped notes about on the night.
Well, I mean, it's worth mentioning the odd little thing that they do to open every song, first of all.
Yes.
Is it starts off as a noodling jam.
It does, you're right.
But to be fair, I think one of the things was, it's worth mentioning at this point, there wasn't a single word spoken in the entire show.
No.
And so that obviously ruled out the drummer counting in the songs.
Yes, you're right.
Then leads to the necessity of someone starting to pick out a rhythm and then somebody else picking it up. And then it sort of coalesces into a song. Yes. But every single song started out as a noodle.
Yes, you did. It's very organic, wasn't it?
It was curious. I mean, it was a thing in of itself. You can't love it or criticize it. It's just that's what he chose to do. That's how he's he organizes his songs these days.
Yes, yes.
The band were tight. I had this feeling sometimes of the rhythm section wanting to go off on their own somewhere.
Okay.
Which I can't quite articulate very well. You'd have to have been there to have heard it, and you were, and you didn't pick up on it. But they were very tight.
Yeah, I mean, this is a band that's been with them, I think, for a number of years now, and they must know him. But, you know, he would, at the end of a song, he would get up and walk over to one of the keyboard players and have a little word in his ear. And then towards the end of a song, you could see him looking up to sort of tell the band when it was time to wrap it up. So maybe as well as they know him, there's still an element of where's Bob going to take us tonight? And we've got to be on our game to make sure we follow him and go where he wants us to go.
A little bit of truth in that, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know whether, you know, if you're not so familiar with the songs that's going to make a difference. But I enjoyed this concert much more than the previous one, which I found frustrating. But it isn't a concert for you to dip your toe into the bucket of nostalgia that you might be wanting to. That's a terrible metaphor. I'm so sorry. But
you're right. I mean, that's why we go to see, say, I mean, the Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney.
Yes.
Or Cat Stevens. As you say, you do want to immerse yourself in the bucket of nostalgia. You want to wallow in it. That's why you go.
Yes.
But Bob Dylan, very, very different. I mean, you know, he still wants to be young. He's wearing the leather trousers at the age of 77.
Yeah.
Reminding me, quite frankly, of Adam Sandler in The Wedding Singer.
Okay. There was one song called Love Sick where he actually walked out from behind the keyboard and stood. So, yeah, holding the microphone stand and doing a slightly rock and roll pose sort of approach to it.
And the drape jacket, he looked the part.
Yes, that's a good... Yeah. You know what I take from it? I take from this that he is still... sees himself as being a vital performer.
Yes.
Because he's changing things so much, because he's not resting on his laurels. And for that reason, I maintain my respect for him, even though I don't necessarily enjoy every particular rendition of the songs he's reworked, because some of them I didn't all like all of the melodies he came up with for some of these old songs.
Yeah,
some of them worked, some of them didn't in my book. But the fact that he did it shows you an artist who's still thinking about what he's doing and trying to present it in a different way. And I thought, okay, that's good. Fine. Good on you.
I hope I can
do that at 77.
The other reading of it is, unfortunately, that he's so far up himself that he doesn't bother to please the crowd in the slightest, hands out what gifts he's got, and the grateful audience.
Yeah. I think that's fair. Except I would say that he's probably been like that for a long time. And so if you were, I would be surprised if he wasn't like that.
But yeah, okay, fair enough.
That is a fair reading. I mean, you could certainly, here's the telling sign, Steve. Sorry, we were going about Mr. Dylan a long time, but he's a big guy.
He is.
The odd time when you could hear an audience member click to what the song was. It'd be a little eruption of applause or approval. Yay, oh, there it is. You know, they were hankering for that tune they knew.
Yeah.
But they didn't get it.
No, it was odd. It was odd. I mean, one thing, if I'm being charitable, I guess the reason why he doesn't talk to the audience much is he received the world's most famous heckle at a rock concert.
I'll remind me.
Manchester Free Trade Hall, 1967.
Oh. Okay.
Judas!
Okay. Oh, you can't get much more telling than that. Okay.
No, this was the never opened his mouth on stage since.
No, God. Anyway, Bob Dylan, I enjoyed it. You not so much, but that's okay. Now, can we move on to another artist?
I think we ought
Steve,
to.
Yes, we should. So Dylan is a guy I've grown up with.
Yep.
I cannot say the same for the American pop singer Katy Perry, Steve. I know she's roared into public consciousness somewhat. See what I did there?
I did, yes, yeah.
And you witnessed her recent show.
Oh, very good, very good.
Oh, I know. So, yeah, anyway, did she leave much of an impression on you?
Well, here's the interesting thing.
Yes.
I look around some of the more flattering reviews that were written about her. The one I've got on our website, cravepodcast.com, is less than flattering.
Okay. I've seen it.
Sorry, because I thought she was frankly barking mad. even the more fangirlish reviews use words like bonkers,
okay,
and extreme, and it was an odd show. I mean, you got the obligatory costume changes, which I think just waste time, to be perfectly honest. But you've got a troupe of backing dancers who again change costumes routinely to match whatever song she was singing. There was one song, which had them wearing TV sets on their heads. Another one that had two dancers come out with massive flamingo puppets. It was all very, very peculiar and very, very staged.
Yeah.
Very, almost clinical. It was very soulless. The music was perfectly functional, adequate, nothing remarkable. Mm-hmm. And then halfway through, does the phrase left shark mean anything to you?
Left shark.
Left shark.
No. Well, I apologise.
Well, here's the thing. Does the phrase Super Bowl mean anything to you?
Yes.
And they always do the great big halftime show during the Super Bowl,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
About 5 years ago, she was the Super Bowl star.
Okay.
And she had backing dancers for one song in shark costumes, and the guy on the left famously danced really badly.
Oh, okay. Now that does ring a bell. Okay, yep.
And
yep,
so she now did an extended, and I mean about 10-minute bit with Left Shark on stage. Right. It was meant to be self-effacing and self-deprecating, I think, to be honest. It came across as being profoundly self-indulgent. It didn't work. And it was just, the whole thing just felt that way from start to finish. It was a production. It felt soulless. It felt self-indulgent. It just didn't click for me in the slightest. The music, I mean, one thing you'll have to say about Bob Dylan is it's all about the music.
Yep.
It's not about him in the slightest. It's about the music. With Katy Perry, it felt the opposite way around.
Okay.
Now, all of that I could have forgiven.
Yes.
Except for one thing that happened before she even came on stage.
Go on.
They got obviously got the obligatory video screens, which Bob Dylan didn't have, you know, because he's Bob.
Yeah.
They got the video screens by the side of the stage to do close-ups of the artiste. And so between support act and her, the video screen showed, among other things, adverts for her line of cosmetics.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
That's just out of order, isn't it? I'm glad you're as disgusted as I am by that.
Goodness. Oh, well, I'm struggling to find the word. That's terrible.
You've paid $150 to go and see your pop star hero, and you have to sit through adverts for a slap. I'm sorry. No, I'm not impressed with that the slightest.
I'm trying to think of anyone else who's I've ever seen who's done such a thing, and I can't.
Well,
oh, golly.
Our intrepid roving reporter, Debbie, does tell me this is becoming increasingly common in the US.
Okay. Well, that just demeans the art to such an extent. You're right. It makes it all about the personality and her, the business, her logo, her everything else, but her art. And that's a great shame.
Yeah,
great shame.
And so, unfortunately, that was front and center in my mind when she walked on stage. And I hate to have to say that she'd lost me before she even opened her mouth. But yeah, that soured things for me considerably. I was very disappointed.
Well,
with that.
Yeah, rightly so. Hey, what is her voice like, by the way, live?
Adequate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of songs when it was about as high in the mix as the backing singers.
Okay.
Which doesn't inspire confidence. There was one moment when she was doing the Left Shark routine where she sang a few verses or a few lines of All By Myself unaccompanied, and she sounded perfectly decent.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm struggling to say positive things. I really am.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I probably wouldn't have rushed out to get a Katy Perry ticket anyway, and I'm certainly not going to do it now. If nothing else, on the basis of I'm not interested in seeing her tell me about why I should rush out and buy some of her cosmetics.
No, I don't think that, I don't think they have your colours, to be honest, anyway. So.
No.
What I will say is, I do want to twist the knife. She deserves it for that one thing alone. you were going to come with me to this concert, and at the last minute you couldn't make it, so I tried to give away the ticket.
Yes.
I couldn't give it away.
Wow.
And frankly, given the adverts I sat through, good.
Yeah, yeah.
Do I sound bitter?
Well, you do, but then I would be as well. I'd be bitter as well.
Glad it shone. Yeah. Glad it shone through.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, I could kick Katy Perry around all night, because that's just this very American of her. So let's go somewhere else.
Yes.
Slightly more down to earth style of music.
Yes.
Passenger. Now you've not been a huge. You're not terribly familiar, I don't think, are you?
No, this is he's an individual artist. This is Michael Rosenberg. He's still calling himself Passenger, right, Steve? But he was actually the front man of a band called Passenger before.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. The band basically split up, and he just kept performing under that name.
Okay, right, gotcha. So you and I have had the chance to have a little sneak preview listen to his new album, which is called Runaway.
I'm hearing huge hesitation in your voices, Simon.
Well,
huge.
You know, okay, he's an English singer-songwriter. I would characterize this as a sort of a middle-of-the-road soft rock with a few of the songs are a bit more upbeat, but there's some nice guitar and stuff. It's pleasant, warm, and engaging sound. He's I find the album has a fairly romantically themed set of songs about heartbreak and looking at the world and life in general. His voice has one of those sort of voices where you feel the artist is trying his hardest to sound heartfelt.
Okay, yeah, that's one reading.
And a touch on the husky side, maybe. I have to say, Steve, I've only listened to the Runaway once, so I should temper my comments and say it's just an initial impression. But I find him pleasant, but not particularly memorable to my ear. Good band, well put together, well produced, but nothing I'm going to say, oh, that's different, I'm going to rush out and buy that. That was my initial impression. I don't know if you're necessarily going to agree with me on that, though.
Well, no, I think that's not entirely unfair. Did he remind you of anybody?
Yeah.
Did he put you in mind of anybody in particular?
Oh, yes. Well, it didn't. It took about 10 seconds for me to think about Mr. Sheeran, I have to say.
Well, oddly enough, he did open for Ed Sheeran 2 years ago in Auckland.
Wow. That's not. Yeah. Okay.
You can see the DNA in there, can't you?
You
can see the thing. You can hear the fingerprints.
Yeah. I mean, even to sort of the nature of what the songs are about.
Well, there's one in particular, I have to say, a song called To Be Free, which tells the story of his father coming to England and meeting Passenger's mother, which does bring to mind Nancy Mulligan from Ed Sheeran's last album, which is how his grandparents met, which does feel a little bit derivative. But hey, it's a nice idea, so why not? If you've got a good story to tell, tell it.
Yeah.
But one thing I will say is his voice in the past, that you're talking about the slightly husky force bit, is always to me been terribly, terribly warbly.
Okay.
And I feel like he's dialing that back a bit. I think that's a good thing.
Well, that probably is an improvement then. On what I just, it felt a little bit trying hard to be that sort of, you know, genuine, emotionally connecting sort of a angsty voice. But I'm not saying it. You know, I think that a lot of people would enjoy the music. It's certainly agreeable and warm and you'd easily have it on the background while you're driving or doing other things. I don't know if I'd necessarily sit down just, you know, quietly by myself and have a listen to it all the way through. It just wouldn't be my cup of tea, but that's all right.
Absolutely. Not everything has to be. It's very pleasant, I have to say. I mean, there's moments. There's a couple of songs. To Be Free, for example, is one where he does actually let his voice go a little bit. He just kind of soar. Yeah. There's a few decent ones. Like Let's Go Again is... You know, he actually lets the band do something and they actually start to rock out a little bit. It doesn't happen an awful lot. It is soft rock, as you say, but as soft rock goes, it's very good.
Okay, fair enough.
And he's coming to Auckland later in the year. In November. It's worth mentioning.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Okay. So for me, in the middle there somewhere, and maybe for you just slightly higher than that, but that's all right. Shine like an oil spill, or rainbow on cartwheels, a dollar coin in the snow. Go fly like a kite in the wind, and you might not ever come down or come home. As if life is an ocean, love is an island, and freedom's a boat you can row. Let's go. Okay, we should leave music to one side, perhaps.
Why not? Is it time to go to the pictures?
I think it is. Yes.
Let's go. So, what have we seen recently?
Well, I think there's this film that has been causing. It has been grabbing a few headlines, hasn't it, Steve? This film. It's just opened the last couple of days, actually. It's featured on the cover of Time. I saw a headline on BBC World Service TV. With the strap line saying it was historic.
It's a bit strange.
I thought so. What we're talking about is, I think, really a standard romantic comedy. The thing is, it's called Crazy Rich Asians, and it is a story about Asian people. It's set in Asia. And that seems to be what's got everyone excited, that as people got very excited about Black Panther sort of in grasping black pride and culture and putting it out there for all to see. I kind of got the sense that some of the writers around the world are thinking, oh, this is what this movie is doing, the same thing for the Asian and Chinese community. I'm not quite sure if I agree with that, but yeah, what are your impressions?
Well, should we do the film itself, or should we talk about the politics?
Maybe we should set up what the story is. You're right, yeah.
Well, the story is your basic romantic comedy, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Your gorgeous young fella falls in love with a gorgeous young girl, and when it's time to meet his family, it turns out that they are the richest people in Singapore.
And she doesn't know.
That she had no idea about, and will they or will they not accept her?
That is it in a nutshell.
Yeah, really. Yep. There's not a whole lot more to it in the 2 hour running time for this film.
Yeah. So we've got the young woman is she's the role is played by an actress called Constance Wu, and she plays a young Chinese American economics professor.
Yes.
Called Rachel Chu. The boyfriend is Nicholas Young, and he's played by Henry Golding. And as you say, Nicholas wants to take Rachel to Singapore because his best mate's getting married over there, and he wants Rachel to meet his mum, who's played by Michelle Yeoh. She's the matriarch of the family, and it's that sort of traditional tension we've seen from many other films between the young love. And there's up against the old traditional ways of conducting family life and marriages and so forth. I mean, that's nothing there that's particularly surprising, is there, Steve?
No, it's fairly straightforward. I mean, we've seen variations on the theme of that story a million times. And what's frustrating about this particular version of it is apparently it's based on a very long novel. So the novel it comes from is quite a long book. And so there's an awful lot of side plots that they want to bring.
Yes.
Like, for example, one of Nick's sisters, Astrid, played by Gemma Chan, is married to a bloke who ends up cheating on her because he wants her attention. Mm. And that little side plot, I think it's possibly four scenes in the entire film.
Mm.
And you end up thinking, well, why even bother with it? Gemma Chan's a way better actress than to dismiss in such a trivial way, and yet it's not done justice. And for my money, they could have left it out. Really,
I agree with that. It was in a way they gave too much attention to it, so that you needed to know more about it.
Yes.
But they didn't go there and finish it off for you.
Exactly. Yeah. On the other hand, you've got the matriarch Eleanor, as you say, Michelle Yeoh plays her, and I mean, she can do no wrong for me.
And me too. I'm a big Michelle Yeoh fan.
and so she brings that glorious tartness and harshness that you'd expect in a character like that.
Yes.
You know, the matriarch who can just look you up and down and then just walk off. I mean, There's hints of Maggie Smith going on there. And she was fantastic. True. But they didn't really give that enough room to breathe. I mean, there's one scene toward the end where Rachel and Eleanor have the inevitable showdown. Mm. You know the scene I'm talking about, I'm sure, yeah?
Yes.
And I thought that was played quite deftly.
It was. Yep.
And I would have liked to have seen an awful lot more of that. And instead, there was an awful lot of Singapore travelogue. There was an awful lot of, look at what rich people do. Aren't they wonderful being rich? That I could have lived without and done more with the development of the characters, the side plots. There's one bit of actual confrontational nastiness when the family make it abundantly clear that they despise, or certain members make out that they despise Rachel. And that's a scene that lasts, a matter of second, then is dismissed.
Yeah.
And I would love to have seen more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they were just trying to stick to that formula of trying to cram as much in as they could. And I think you're right. I think some of the characters were neglected because there was a usual sort of array of side characters there for comic relief. And some of them, I thought, did quite a nice little job. Go Pek Lin plays Awkwafina, who's sort of
all the way around.
Awkwafina plays Go Pek Lin. Sorry about that. And she does a nice job.
She's the best thing in it.
Yeah, yeah. Even old Ken Jeong plays, I think, Go's father.
Yeah, and he's the worst thing in it.
Overacting to hell, but it's sort of so overacting. I thought it was kind of funny because he was so bad. Anyway,
and also the other one that I really like was Oliver Tien playing. I'm doing the same thing you're doing. Nick Santos playing Oliver Tien, who's like the family's gay best friend.
Yes,
and he was great fun. He was really good.
I've just got to mention one part of the plot that very early on really I thought they made a terrible mistake. There's a lovely sequence at the beginning where some other young Asian woman sees Nicholas and Rachel out together.
Yes.
And the word spreads quickly on social media, and they do a lovely little sequence of the graphics, and it's quite fun and it's fresh and it moves along. There's nice music. So that within a matter of seconds, and this is at the beginning, so I hope you don't mind me spoiling this. Within a matter of seconds, everyone knows.
Yeah, that was a really nicely done scene, wasn't
it? Was. Yet, we are expected to believe that Rachel, an intelligent, modern woman, a professor who's teaching young people in the modern digital age, has not figured out that her boyfriend is from the richest family in Singapore. She never googled her boyfriend. Come on,
that's a really gaping plot hole, isn't it?
Yeah. I just thought, come on, that this is so unbelievable. It might have worked 50 years ago, but in today's day and age, I just thought that was didn't fly at all for me.
That's a very, very good point. Right.
Yeah.
So we've done the film. Should we do the politics of the film?
Yeah. Well, yes. So I tell you what, I actually thought there was a big bet. You know, it wasn't so much about the cultural thing for me, Steve. I just thought there was a big battle of ideas between old world and new world.
Yes.
Between America and China.
Plot, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there was some weird, Michelle Yeoh's character says to Rachel, "Oh, you know, you're just out for yourself. You just want to be happy.
Yes.
You got to put aside your happiness and for the common good." So it's kind of, that's all about the American individualism, isn't it? I mean, isn't that what that's going on there?
Very much so. Yes.
Yeah. And at the same time as they were trying to say that Rachel is, an even better person than the rest because she comes from good working class stock and she's had to battle hard to get to the top and she's got there. The film sort of mocks the richness of these crazy, crazy Asians in Singapore.
Yeah.
It sort of also celebrates their richness in a way. I mean, it doesn't. I felt that there was, kind of was having a quid both ways there, I thought.
There was a little bit of wealth porn going on, wasn't there?
Yeah, wealth porn. Yeah. Yeah, there was. Yeah. There was. And so I think there was got a bit mixed up, those messages there in a little way. And I thought also just one other point struck me was, and I've just forgotten what that point was now. It was kind of a travelogue, wasn't it? There were wonderful scenes of Singaporean cuisine, street markets, lavish banquets. So there was a lot of celebrating the culture of Asia, celebrating family connection. Okay, they were showing that everyone bitches at each other, but hey, what family doesn't do that?
Yep.
At the same, so celebrating it, but also putting it down. And I found that slightly odd mixture somehow. It didn't quite settle. There's a tension there that I didn't feel was well written.
Yeah.
This is what I'm trying to say. Forgive me for dancing around that.
No, I think I know where you're going with that one. But I think part of the problem is I mean, I take exception, I always have done, to the word Asians.
Right, right.
What the hell's an Asian?
Well, that depends. Well, that's a good point. I mean, in Britain, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if you say Asian in Britain, you're more likely to be referring to an Indian or Pakistani or Bangladeshi. Would that be fair?
That's British Asians, yes.
Yes,
That's the residence that we have.
Yeah. In New Zealand, we would tend to think of Chinese or Japanese or Thai or... that would be what... So you're right. There's that element. Yep.
So, for Asians is such a vague thing. You know, this film is supposed to be all about Singapore. I had a quick look. You know, there isn't a single Singaporean in the cast.
Is that right?
Yeah, but Asians, let's say, you know, the Orientals, they're interchangeable, it would appear.
Yeah.
That didn't sit well with me. There's been criticism. Yes, it's got an Asian cast. It's got a Far Eastern and an Oriental cast. Mm. But it still managed to get its own little bit of racial ugliness into it. You'll notice anytime anyone spoke Cantonese, there were subtitles on the screen.
Yes.
The one time that someone spoke Malay, they didn't bother.
Oh, okay. I didn't pick that up. Okay, yeah. That's interesting.
But then you could be forgiven for thinking that Singapore was an exclusively Chinese town anyway. In this film.
Yes. Yeah.
Except for, it's still okay to be scared of Indians.
Yes. You're true. True. Yes, that was... Yeah, and the other thing was that you couldn't help but notice that the rich Singaporean family all spoke with English accents because they'd been to British boarding schools.
Well, of course.
Whereas our heroine Rachel comes from America and is, you know, has a stock American, middle American accent, and that seemed to be part of the class war that was going on there.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it, Nicholas Yong grew up in England, or the actor, I beg your pardon, Henry Golding grew up in England.
Right,
Gemma Chan was born in England.
Okay.
You know, you've got largely an English cast, to be absolutely honest.
Yeah. So, but should we be celebrating the fact that it is a mainstream film with set in Singapore? Is that something that we should welcome and celebrate? I guess that's the other big question that other media have been talking about.
Yeah, why not? I mean, the world is not exclusively white. I think we finally realise that.
Yes, we certainly have. So that's I agree. I mean, it shouldn't be a big deal, but I guess it is. But it shouldn't be.
It has taken the world a while to figure that one out, and it's certainly taken Hollywood a wee while to twig that there are people who aren't white and aren't male who do actually have talent and stories to tell.
Yeah, and I've got to say, there was one line spoken by Rachel near the end where she talks about being an immigrant.
Yep.
Poor.
Yep.
Having to struggle, and yes, she got to the top. And one, I certainly, when that she delivered that line, I thought, you know, yet again, my mind goes back to the Trumpian age in which we live and his attack on immigrants. And I don't know if that was at all in the writer's mind, but it drew my mind went to that issue about, you know, immigrants in richer society, and even if they're poor, they can work their way up to do good things and contribute well, whether that was part of it or not. But that's a little lesson I drew from it.
Nice little tangent there, Simon. Well played.
Thank you. All right.
So what do you reckon? Are we going to recommend that people buy a ticket for this?
Well, I think if you're in the mood for a romantic comedy, you're going to probably enjoy it. I mean, there's some nice comic touches in the film.
Yeah.
There's nothing very surprising about it, but it's possibly a bit long, I thought, but it's... some fantastic scenery.
Oh,
there's some
yeah.
nice music.
Gorgeous people in gorgeous places.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a lot to enjoy just purely from a don't think about it too much, just sit back and lap it all up. And I think on that score, it's as good as any other romantic comedy I've seen in recent times, really. It's fine. It's and you've got Michelle Yeoh, so hey.
Can't be all bad, can it?
Can't all be all bad. That's right.
Okay, well, let's move on to something that quite frankly to me sounds like it is all bad.
Yes. So I'm going to, yes. We're talking sharks, okay? And I'm a bit older than you, so I have very good memories, Steve, of around about 40, maybe it's a bit more than 40 years ago, seeing a film called Jaws, directed by Steven Spielberg. I suspect you were a bit of a young lad back then, were you?
I did see it, but I was a child.
Okay. Well, it's fair to say that even though the technology used in that film is dated terribly, and the big shark looks like a mechanical shark, such was the strength of the writing and the time given to developing the characters in this film that it's memorable. Still, I think you'd go back now and I think you'd quite enjoy it. There were three main characters. Roy Scheider played this Brody, the police chief. The wonderful Robert Shaw played the crusty sea captain Quint, and Richard Dreyfuss played the oceanographer called Hooper. And their interaction on board the boat while they're chasing the shark made for a really memorable piece of drama.
Yeah, I mean, directed by Steven Spielberg.
You put
those three together with a director like that. How are you not going to have a film for the ages?
It is a film for the ages, and it made people scared to go to the water for, you know, for years. Now we go forward. There have been many, many shark movies since, and there's been a bit of a glut of them in recent times. And now we have The Meg, another film with a strong Asian production input and financing, although actually largely filmed in New Zealand, I believe. And I know this because my partner Sharon's brother, Grant, worked on the set and worked in Henderson and QMU.
Does that mean we have to be really flattering about the film, then?
I hope he's not listening. But this is a movie that has much, much better special effects than Steven Spielberg's. Meg refers to a megalodon, one of those prehistoric, massively huge sharks that apparently has died out, but this film gives us a way in which it hasn't. And so this deep sea exploratory research station discovers one, it escapes to the surface, terrorizes everyone, and they've got to try and deal to it. That's the story right there. And you've got, again, some Chinese characters and actors in significant roles in the film. The romantic double at the front are the British actor Jason Statham, who I think you'd be fair to say, Steve, is a kind of action kind of a hero,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Sort
of hard edge, gritty Londoner. Was he a London accent? I don't know what it is. It's sort of working class English accent.
Yeah, he's Jason Statham, isn't he?
That's right, isn't it? Yeah, right like that. And
you looking at me, shark.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly it. Thank you. And Li Bingbing plays the woman who is the scientist who he kind of teams up with. And they clearly have romantic feelings towards each other. But this is a film with quite a strong family-oriented presentation. And
did you just say oriented?
Oh, I did too. I didn't mean to.
You did, didn't you?
And thank you. And so it's kind of a family-friendly thriller. So Jason Statham and Li Bingbing never hug, never kiss, never embrace or have any physical contact, really. They smile at each other, which is quite odd seeing Jason Statham smile. I'm just using it to seeing him with a set jaw.
Not an image that springs readily to mind.
And it looks odd when you see it, and he does it quite a lot.
He's not known for his sensitive side, is he?
No. Anyway, it's like Crazy Rich Asians. The story is quite predictable. There are some thrills, absolutely. You know, when you finally get to see the big shark, it looks pretty scary. But our hero, unlike Roy Scheider in Jaws, doesn't bat an eyelid that he's got a massive shark trying to chomp him in one bite. So.
Of course, he's Jason Statham, isn't he?
He's Jason Statham,
punch the shark.
Well, it's kind of what he does. And so it's very much a popcorn piece of matinee movie making rather than a hard-edged thriller. So you've got to bear that in mind. It's done quite well at the box office, I think, Steve. And I think it's, you know, so people are still drawn to shark movies. And fair enough. But it's a bit of a predictable romp and a little bit – fell a bit flat. It's not. I'm not going to remember scenes from that movie as much as I'm going to remember Jaws, which, for all its lesser technical skill that was able to be drawn on back then, has much more memorable characters.
Fair enough. You've not sold me in the slightest.
No.
Cash stays in pocket.
I think that's a fair call. I think that's an absolutely fair call. Yes, good on you.
Fair enough. So if I stay at home, rather than going to the pictures, what could I be doing at home when I could instead of going to see the Stafe punching
the
a shark?
The Stafe. Is that what they call them these days?
So I'm led to believe, yes.
Yeah, fair enough. What you could do, if you're in the mood for something serious, and I mean serious, is read a graphic novel called Sabrina, which I talked about last time.
You mentioned this before, haven't you?
Yeah. So this is the first time a graphic novel has been nominated for Britain's Man Booker Literary Prize. And that drew my attention to it when I saw this on the news the week or two back. So I went out and bought it. I rushed through it initially because I just wanted to see where the story was taking me. But in fact, I needed to really slow down. And I've gone back and read it a second time. And I've got greater rewards from it, although reward is an interesting word to use because this is a story really about loss and isolation. It's pretty heavy going. Sabrina is a 27-year-old woman from Chicago, Sabrina Gallo. We meet her at the beginning of the story. We don't get to know her that well because she disappears mysteriously at first. And the story is about how her disappearance profoundly affects her family, her friends, her boyfriend, and eventually, through in the age of social media, the whole of the United States.
Right.
And it's written and drawn by a chap called Nick Drnazzo. Drnazzo, name.
You should know to pronounce that.
Slow moving. I know. Drnazzo, I think. Anyway. It's not a light read. Forget about superhero comics. Forget about horror movie comics. You know, this is no Walking of the Dead or Captain America or anything like that. This is a serious bit of writing. It's drawn in a simple style. It's not the characters have fairly plain sort of faces. things move relatively slowly. The dialogue is quite realistic. But what's going on is it slowly draws you into a story of what happens when someone goes missing and what it's like to lose someone, how your emotional responses, be they sadness, anger, frustration, how when it's not clear what happened, people can start having suspicions and start accusing each other of things. And this is where the social media comes into it, Steve.
Yeah.
It plays on some of those in America who follow sort of a very anti-government sort of republic line of thinking that, you know, the government's out to get us and they're yeah. hiding things from us all the time. So, and it doesn't have a nice, neat resolution at the end. It is a rewarding book, but it is a serious book. I do recommend it, but you know, you've got to be in the right frame of mind to want to tackle it.
Yeah.
But it is an example of you know, there've been a number of other comic books which have gone down this road. I think over the years that I'm thinking that there was the one that tackled Hitler. That's not right. Nazi Germany. There was a series of books with mice as the main characters. What were they called again? Anyway, so you know, from time to time, graphic novels tackle serious subjects, and this is one such novel to be recommended if you're in the mood for taking your time and a serious piece of work. I'll just leave it at that. There'll be a review on the website shortly. You can take your time reading that.
Now that one, I have to tell you, it sounds an awful lot more interesting than Shark Punching.
Yeah, it is. And it's written in this moment, Steve. So it's very much sort of our time in 2018, right. What the world's like now.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a document of our time, I suppose, in that regard. So, yeah, it's I won't remember the Meg, but I might remember Sabrina. Yeah.
Sounds good to me. I should look out for that, yeah.
All right, okay. Very good. So, look, what's coming up the next little while, actually, Steve, in terms of concerts and the like?
Glad you asked.
Well, hey.
Because we've got a couple of things to mention. First one that's been announced just recently is, I'm kind of sad I'll be out of the country when this one comes around.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden.
Okay.
He's quite an interesting chap by all accounts.
Right.
Not only is he lead singer of Iron Maiden, he's also an airline pilot.
Oh, okay. I think I've heard that before. Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay.
I mean, you know, he pilots their tour jets around the world, but he also flies for, I think he possibly has an ownership interest in, a charter airline out of the UK, and so he actually is a working pilot.
Okay, so okay.
He's a very keen aviator. And so he's written a book about his life and times.
Yep.
Called What Does This Button Do? And he's going to do a spoken word tour. He's going to be doing basically a speaking tour of the world, as far as I can tell. But he's going to be in Auckland on Tuesday, the 16th of October.
Okay. And he's that's a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. He's going to be at the Cordis Hotel. He used to be the Langham there, up at the Grafton Street there. Yeah.
All right.
And so that could actually be really, really interesting. I gather he's actually quite a witty, an entertaining speaker.
Okay, that sounds great. Hey, so and you've by the way, of course, you keep us up to date on our cravepodcast.com website with various tour announcements. A certain chap who used to play drums for Genesis is coming too.
Yes, Phil Collins. Well, he's not coming that close.
Okay.
Yeah, Phil Collins. Doing, oddly enough, his Not Dead Yet tour. Seriously.
You can't tour when you're dead.
Well, I don't know. Bob Dylan looks like he's giving you serious thoughts. No, he's going to be in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. He's going to be in Christchurch on the 4th of February at Christchurch Stadium.
Yep.
And then on Waitangi Day, he's going to be in Napier.
Okay.
And that's it.
Ah, okay. You're not. Yeah. All right. Oh well. So be it.
Yeah. You're right to say what? No, Auckland. No, he's not coming up here.
Right.
So he's dead to us.
Yeah.
We don't care about that one.
No. Now the other one I just mentioned, because you and I a year or so back, maybe it's more than a year ago, we went to see AC/DC.
Yes.
At Western Springs, I think it was, and the band that got them going, if I got this right, was She Had. I'm pretty sure that they opened for AC/DC.
There were two opening acts. It was Villainy, and then there was She Had.
And I enjoyed She Had quite a lot that day. I thought they were right into it. And yeah, they've
got
it. That
was the first time I'd seen them, and they were pretty powerful, weren't they?
Yeah. And you've got an announcement about them doing a 30th anniversary tour. For goodness sake, they've been around for a while.
They had, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't guess it, would you? I mean, the energy they played with that night, you wouldn't think that was, you know, more than a quarter of a century into their career.
Yes.
So, yeah,
I think
they're coming to Auckland toward the end of a 6-day tour. They're in Christchurch, Wellington, New Plymouth, Hamilton, Auckland, and then Mount Maunganui. So they're doing the
rounds. This is in October, right?
This is going to be kicks off on the 19th of October in Christchurch, and then goes through to the 27th of October in Mount Maunganui. Again, cravepodcast.com has all the dates and the venues. Yep. But yeah, that's going to be one worth seeing, I think, to be honest.
Very good. Okay. Anything else before we move along? We wrap this up, as they say in showbiz. Yeah.
Well, there's one other. I don't think it's quite going to be quite your thing.
Yes.
But it's kind of a big name. Are you familiar with the Wu-Tang Clan?
I've heard of the Wu-Tang Clan, but I'm not familiar with their material. I'm so sorry, but I think they're heading this way. But are you a fan?
Not in the slightest.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not a genre of music I'm a huge fan of, but I am aware of their influence. I do know that within their field, they are big names. I'm aware of that much, obviously. Now, what I do know is that they're kind of like not really a conventional band. They're sort of a collective, a loose collective. And some of the members, such as Method Man, have gone on to have fairly successful individual careers. And they sort of weave in and out of each other, and sometimes they do stuff together in various combinations. But this is going to be the first time ever that all nine of them have performed together in New Zealand.
Okay. All right.
So that's going to be Horncastle Arena in Christchurch on 13th of December. And then the next night, the 14th, they're going to be at the Trust Stadium in Auckland.
Jolly good. Excellent. Thank you very much, Mr. McCabe. We should go, I think.
I think it's that time of the evening.
I'm
going to go and read Sabrina, I think.
Yeah. Have a stiff drink at your side. In the meantime, we look forward to your company again. We're always pleased to hear from you. By all means, drop us an email. You can do that by writing to podcast@cravepodcast.com.
If email's not your thing, you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
That's a very cunningly devised title, Twitter handle, isn't it?
Hours of thought, mate.
That's why they pay you the big bucks. In the meantime, I'm Simon Mercip.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.